Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. When is tax analysis not really tax analysis? You think about that, we'll get you the answer straight ahead. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, December the 12th. Good as always to have you here, everybody. I know I say that all the time, but I really mean it. We are going to do taxes here in a minute, but first, a brief detour to the federal budget, the defense side of the House. I'm bringing it up because President Trump signed the National Defense Authorization Act today. It calls for around $700 billion in defense spending for fiscal year 18, which, yes, I know, started 2 months ago. The thing is, spending that much money, $700 billion, would blow right through the sequestration spending caps the Congress agreed to back in 2011, if you remember those. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer gets us going with the GOP's budget math on this.
The bill President Trump signed today is basically a very expensive wish list. It's not a spending bill. It doesn't actually provide any money.
It sets the table, but it doesn't put turkey on your plate.
That's Todd Harrison. He's with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says Congress has to appropriate this defense money and agree to blow through the spending caps that were created to rein in the deficit. Republicans would need some votes from Democrats to do that. And Democrats will probably insist on raising the caps on non-defense spending, too. Harrison says that's for stuff like
Homeland Security, the State Department, Veterans Affairs, all sorts of other agencies in the government.
The Democrats know they've got some leverage, but if Congress does vote to allow all of this spending over the caps, it won't be the first time. Catherine Blakely is with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments.
Since 2011, every year we've been able to increase the defense and non-defense side of those caps by some amount, an average of $19 billion.
But this time, defense spending would be $85 billion over the cap. John Gilmore teaches public policy at William & Mary. He says it's clear the spending caps aren't working for Congress.
They were trying to blackmail themselves that if they didn't cut the budget deficit, then these horrible caps would go into effect.
Gilmore says Congress should admit the spending caps are a failed experiment. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Republican leaders on Capitol Hill have been hinting today that they are really close to an agreement on a final tax bill. More likely, there is much more work left to be done on the thing. But what we do know is that there's been near unanimous GOP scorn for the non- or bipartisan analysis showing the bill would add $1 trillion at least to the national debt and not increase economic growth anywhere near what congressional Republicans and the Trump administration have been promising. Enter this week the Treasury Department, which is out with the official executive branch position on the bill, a one-page summary of it. Ben White is the chief economic correspondent at Politico. We called him up to talk about it. Ben, it's good to have you back.
Great to be here, Kai.
Let me ask you something. Can you do analysis of a 450-page tax bill on a one sheet of paper?
No, you can't. That is way too short a space to analyze this giant of a change in the tax code. So the short answer there is no.
The next question then is, where do they get this stuff at the Department of Treasury to put out on the one sheet?
Well, usually it would be the Office of Tax Policy that would put out a large analysis of the tax proposals going through Capitol Hill right now. That's not really what this is. The one-pager says that the Office of Tax Policy within Treasury basically takes the same view on this thing as the Joint Committee on Taxation, that if you include dynamic growth effects from this, it would still add around $1 trillion to the deficit and the debt over 10 years. What they've added on to that is a request to the Office of Tax Policy to assume that we get close to 3% growth for 10 years from the tax cuts, and plus all this other stuff we're going to do on infrastructure and welfare reform and regulatory changes. What would happen then if we had all that? And that's where they get to, hey, maybe this thing would pay for itself.
All right. So let's take this apart a little bit. First of all, the 2.9% economic growth that the Treasury Department says we're going to get, that is not in accordance with virtually any other substantive piece of analysis of these bills.
No, it's not. Nobody who's analyzed these things, and there's a lot of analysis out there, suggests that we're going to bump up growth to 3%. Maybe you get it for a year or half a year or whatever, but you don't get it for 10 consecutive years, or 2.9% to be precise. That is not even close to projections for this tax bill that, you know, range from anywhere from like 0.5 to 0.7% additional GDP over 10 years. So it's way out of line with any other analysis of this thing.
Okay. The other thing you mentioned, which is item two on my list, is they're counting on other things that the administration has talked about but not yet done. Infrastructure and welfare reform. And they do talk about deregulation, which they've done a bunch of there.
Correct. Yeah, they have done a bunch of deregulation they're attempting to anyway, in the financial industry, the energy industry, healthcare industry. Some of it they've done, some of it they plan to do, and they count on that for an additional growth burst, as well as you mentioned, an infrastructure plan that they've talked about. President Trump talked about it on the campaign trail, but they haven't proposed anything, and there's absolutely no guarantee that even if they did, that an infrastructure plan would get through Congress.
All right. So here's the bigger question then, Ben. When you have the Speaker of the House and substantive members of the House and the Senate saying, in essence, none of this other analysis matters, we're going to go with our assumptions, putting their fingers in their ears and going la, 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 la on objective analysis. What does that mean the next time there's a big bill? Do we have the death of analysis here, I guess, is the question.
I don't know if the analysis is dead, Kai, but it's certainly on life support after what we've seen in this bill, basically devaluing all nonpartisan analysis that says through empirical evidence, this is what this bill is likely to do. It's likely to produce minimal growth, a lot of new debt, and Republicans just saying, as you said, sticking their fingers in their ears and saying, we don't care what the experts say. We don't care what the analysis says. And I mean, we should remember that it was Republicans' idea in the first place to score a lot of these bills yep. with dynamic scoring, this idea that, you know, you get a growth effect, and now they're devaluing that. So it's definitely knocked down the idea that we can rely on empirical analysis.
Just to remind everybody, this thing comes up for a vote probably next week, right?
Yeah, that's correct. The conference committee, they hope, gets done this week, sends it to the floor of both houses next week. No guarantees. They're still arguing yeah. about a bunch of stuff, but they hope to do that.
Ben White, chief economic correspondent at Politico. He does a newsletter as well and a podcast. He's a triple threat. Ben, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Traders, today we're betting the tax bill is going to pass. We're going to have the details when we do the numbers. There's some new research out today about the economic trouble that Puerto Rico is in and will be in for some time to come. Nearly 3 months after Hurricane Maria, as you know, rebuilding on the island is still glacially slow. And even before the storm hit, the island was in default on tens of billions of dollars in debt. In an opinion piece in the Washington Post today, a trio of academics, including Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, to just drop a name here, they say Puerto Rico has no capacity to make any debt payments at all in the next 10 years, which means some kind of debt restructuring or forgiveness, as President Trump actually said at one point, might be inevitable. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth has more on that one.
First, why does Puerto Rico owe all this money again? Well, you remember the Great Recession, right? Really devastating. It took years, but eventually we bounced back. Puerto Rico didn't.
Puerto Rico had been in economic decline since 2005.
Antonio Weiss of Harvard's Kennedy School looked at the numbers. He says in 2014, Puerto Rico issued municipal bonds with a massive 8.5% interest rate. Hedge funds, hungry for high yield, snapped them up. And when Puerto Rico couldn't pay, took them to court.
It put Puerto Rico in the impossible position of having to choose between paying bondholders or providing essential services. Think hospitals, firemen, police, schools.
The debt had become unsustainable, but there was no mechanism to restructure debt.
Economist Vicente Feliciano says the 2016 law known as PROMESA became that mechanism. A bipartisan oversight board drew up a sort of payment plan, which involved reducing that bond debt by 75 to 80 cents on the dollar.
Regrettably, once we start on that track, Maria comes around.
Antonio Weiss says now that pre-Maria payment plan doesn't make sense.
There is no room, based on any realistic forecast of Puerto Rico's economy, for there to be hard and fast debt payments in the next 10 years.
The only way he sees Puerto Rico even having money to pay back creditors is for Congress to approve a recovery package that gets the island's economy back on track. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
For all the talk here and elsewhere of the problems that big retail malls find themselves in, there is still money to be made. Europe's biggest commercial landlord announced plans today to buy the Australian mall conglomerate Westfield for almost $16 billion. It's a story of consolidation in the face of the internet, as Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
You'll find Westfield's red logo posted outside fancy shopping centers from Los Angeles to London. Floris van Dijkum at brokerage Benning & Scattergood says, like all mall operators, Westfield has been feeling the strain, but many of the malls in its portfolio are still going strong.
75% of the value of Westfield is in A malls.
A malls are the creme de la creme of U.S. shopping centers, those expected to survive the right sizing of physical retail playing out across the country. To acquire Westfield, French property group Unibail-Rodamco agreed to pay an 18% premium over yesterday's closing price. Westfield chairman Frank Lowy founded the company back in 1960. In a webcast this morning, the 87-year-old said the price was right.
This is obviously a day of mixed emotion for me, but I'm 100% comfortable with our decision.
Lowy built something quite rare in the shopping mall industry, says Gil Luria at brokerage D.A. Davidson, a globally recognizable brand name.
Unibail can leverage that to brand some other malls and utilize the fact that there's name recognition from the American and British malls.
Westfield's red logo could soon be on Unibail's 70 malls in Europe. Luria says the new company will be able to leverage the fact that it's one of the few places large retailers looking for a global footprint can go.
They can make sure that they're getting paid the higher rents and that they're getting a better cut of the economics.
If the deal goes through, the new company would become the second largest mall operator in the world, behind Indiana-based Simon Property Group. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
We learned about a week or so ago that CVS, the big pharmacy chain, is going to spend $69 billion to buy the health insurance giant Aetna. Insert relevant caveats here about regulatory approval and all of that. CVS, you might know, is already in the healthcare business, basic in-store care in what are called minute clinics. And Aetna and its policyholders could present quite the expansion opportunity, though. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains.
21-year-old Kimberly Nunez woke up one morning, her eye swollen by a sty. The child care worker called her doctor.
The doctor wasn't in that day or something happened that doctor couldn't go in. So when I called, they just told me to go to urgent care somewhere where they could handle it.
Nunez decided her best option was a CVS Minute Clinic in Philadelphia.
No calling, no nothing. Easy. It's very convenient. It's always a second option.
These kinds of clinics started sprouting up more than 15 years ago. Walgreens and the grocery chain Kroger's each have several hundred, but CVS is the leader with 1,100. With convenient hours and an average charge of $80, CVS says it handles 5 million appointments a year, often to treat simple stuff, ear infections, the flu, routine lab tests for diabetes or high blood pressure. But here's the big problem with minute clinics, at least for some. They often don't save consumers money.
We found that the majority of visits did not represent replacement of an ED visit, emergency department visit, or doctor's office visit.
Dr. Ativ Mehrotra is a health policy professor at Harvard.
What does that mean? It means people who otherwise would have been at home with their cold and they had chicken soup now are going and getting care.
Long story short, Mehrotra says people end up spending more money because they go to the minute clinic and to the doctor's office. CVS wants to change that. By buying Aetna, CVS all of a sudden has 47 million Aetna customers it can nudge into getting more of their care in the clinics with incentives, for example, like no copays to treat sinus infections. Beyond that, CVS's chief medical officer, Troyan Brennan, says the company plans to create what it calls healthcare hubs, where people can get fitted for glasses, their hearing tested, or buy a walker.
What we want to do is begin to convert the stores over time, but relatively rapidly, into places where people can get concierge services related to their health so that we have a full picture of their health care and that we can help guide them.
But that's not all CVS wants. The company is also going after a healthcare goldmine. People with chronic conditions, responsible for 80% of healthcare spending. Simply, CVS can make more money controlling diabetes than treating a sore throat. But these patients often have long-term relationships with their specialists, which they want to maintain, says Dr. Alan Corey, a consultant with Willis Towers Watson.
So for this to work, patients need to be assured that the information that they divulge at a MinuteClinic is available to their doctors.
These patients must trust the clinic is an extension of the doctor's office, says Corey, where patient records are accessible and care is coordinated. To do that, CVS must convince them to share that data. But if they do, doctors and hospitals are effectively allowing a slice of their business to walk out the door.
Relationships need to be built. Contracts need to be put in place.
With Aetna in the fold, CVS has more of an advantage, namely the insurer's 47 million patients who can be dangled as leverage to negotiate some kind of deal with the doctors and hospitals. But those hospitals and doctors still might not want to play ball. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
He was arrested and held for a couple of days, just long enough for the Italian prince to win the race.
A tale of intrigue and a particular shade of red. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 118 today, 0.4%, 24,504. The NASDAQ actually off-slid 12 points, about a 10%, 68.62. S&P 500, 4 points to the upside, a 10%, 26.64. The Fed meets today, and tomorrow banks are banking on a rate hike. Bank of America up 1.3% today. Capital One headed up 0.2%. Some mall-owning companies went higher on the news of that Westfield deal we told you about. Simon Property Group pushed up 2.5%. Maze Rich gained 5%. Regency Centers advanced 1.3% today. Bonds down. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.40%. You're listening to Marketplace. Here's an investment opportunity with a guaranteed return. When you donate to support Marketplace today, your gift is going to be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at Candida. Listeners like you who give to Marketplace do more than help keep the show on the air. You help us grow and get better. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you can trust. And the payoff comes with what you hear every day. So please don't miss out on this chance to make your donation go twice as far. Give today at marketplace.org. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Marriage rates in this country have been falling since the late 1960s, but not evenly across the economic spectrum. Until the late 60s, most people got and stayed married, regardless of their income. Today, more than half of middle class and wealthy adults are married, but only a quarter of poor Americans are. And the institution of marriage aside, there is plenty of evidence that kids do better with two parents in the house. So Marketplace's Amy Scott looked into one program in Baltimore that is trying to help low-income couples, married or not, build more stable families.
Robert Johnson and Tanisha Asamu sit knee-to-knee, gazing into each other's eyes.
I appreciate your patience because I know I'm not always the easiest person to deal with.
I appreciate how important family is to you, including us, of course, and I really like that.
It's not the most romantic setting. They're in a conference room at the Center for Urban Families, a social services organization in Baltimore. The exercise is part of a class designed to help low-income couples raising children build more solid relationships. Counselor Scott Davis tells the group that regular appreciation is one way to fill a partner's so-called love bank.
Do you know what happens when you have a $100 argument and there's $2 worth of love in your partner's love bank? You get insufficient funds. That's when you start yelling and screaming at each other. That's what's happening.
Seven couples, all unmarried, meet here twice a week for 8 weeks. The program provides transportation to the center and childcare with a literacy program for the kids. Between sessions on conflict resolution, parenting, and budgeting, the couples have dinner. To make it a little more date nighty, caterers deck out the conference room tables with black tablecloths and fresh flowers.
The food is good. The dinner, that's like a big selling point that they sell.
Johnson and Asamu have been together about 5 months. She's a school secretary. He drives a taxi.
That's actually how I met her. I used to transport the kids back and forth to her school. Mm-hmm. And I used to see her every day. She's like the prettiest girl in the school.
They each have a child from a previous relationship and hope to get married. But Asamu says they have a few things to learn.
I really want to be more financially responsible. Like, I want to get a house, things like that. So how to work together, make it happen.
If they do tie the knot, Johnson and Asamu would be in the minority. Just 39% of working-class Americans are married, and only 26% of adults considered poor. That's compared to 56% of middle- and upper-class adults.
This marriage divide in America leaves many working-class and poor kids doubly disadvantaged.
That's Brad Wilcox with the Institute for Family Studies, who published a paper on the topic this fall. He says those children not only grow up with less income.
They also now have access to less of their second parents' time and attention, usually their father's time and attention.
There are lots of reasons for the divide. In this economy, it's harder for men without college degrees to achieve financial stability. Some say programs like Medicaid and food stamps can discourage lower-income couples from marrying to avoid losing benefits. Christy Williams is a sociology professor at The Ohio State University. She says while it's tempting to see marriage as a cure for poverty,
it's really that poverty and the circumstances in which the poor live in the U.S. are actually themselves huge barriers to entering and sustaining the kind of marriages that are healthy environments for children.
And Williams says government efforts to promote marriage, like the Healthy Marriage Initiative funded through welfare dollars, have done little to improve children's economic well-being.
The last time I looked, about $1 billion had been spent on these programs throughout the U.S., and that's $1 billion that are not being used to improve the economic circumstances more directly for families and children.
Baltimore's Center for Urban Families has received some of that funding and will soon get its own evaluation. So far, about 130 couples have graduated from the relationship program. The center also follows up and offers services such as job training and a responsible fatherhood program. A handful have gotten married. Robert Johnson and Tanisha Asamu hope they might be next.
We'll try to get this program to pay for it. They don't know it yet. But
they do now. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The fundamental idea of this program is that there's a business and or economic angle to everything, up to and including color, the subject of an every now and then series we are doing, which lands today on the color red. Not just any red, though, a shade called Rosso Corsa, if I'm pronouncing that right. Italy uses it in international car races, has dating back to 1907, and a competition then to see if it was even possible to drive a car from what was then Peking to Paris. Cassia St. Clair tells the story in her book. It's called The Secret Lives of Color.
The race began, and very soon there were two cars that seemed like they might make it to Paris after all. The first was raced by an Italian prince called Prince Borghese, and he, being a proud Italian man, had insisted that his car was entirely made in Italy and was also allegedly painted bright poppy red. The second car was being raced by essentially a trickster. I don't think he'd even driven a car before, but had somehow managed to con his way into being given a car for free. It looked for a while like the confidence trickster might win, mostly, I think, because of the prince's arrogance. For example, while he was travelling through Russia, he heard that he had been invited to St. Petersburg to a dinner being given in his honour. And despite the fact that St. Petersburg was in fact some 1,000 miles out of his way, he decided to attend this dinner. So it looked like the confidence trickster might win. However, when he got over the border into France, he was arrested and held for a couple of days. just long enough, as it turned out, for the Italian prince to win the race. After such a heroic win, the Italians grasped this bright red colour. It became their national racing colour and has been used pretty much ever since in all the kind of classic cars like the Ferraris and the Alfa Romeos have often been painted this brilliant scarlet colour.
Cassia St. Clair from her book, The Secret Lives of Colour. This final note on the way out today, political memorabilia edition from the pages of The Washington Post. This item, the lock from the door to the Democratic National Committee offices at the Watergate that was pried open in June of 1972 by perhaps the most inept band of political operatives ever, is going up for auction. It's lot number 52 in the catalog from Nate Sanders Auction. Starting bid, how much do you think, huh? $50,000. Fed's meeting today and tomorrow. Interest rates probably going up, so Wall Street was just kind of marking time. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Heathcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is our executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.